This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad. Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to another exciting edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones, and joining me, of course, is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
You must cut out all those different, like a cancerous growth. It is essential. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm ranting again.
Okay. Tonight we are having a little bit of a special, as it is a double of the Twilight Zone. This is a show which, if you're obviously a long-time listener to the show, you would know the history of this show, that what huge fans, both myself and Lackey, are of the Twilight Zone. And I think perhaps on a different timeline, this show would just be all Twilight Zone and Outer Limits episodes. And back when we were obviously constructing the show, there was a time when it was going to just be that, and we sort of decided against it and went with our current structure where we look at, you know, a wide variety of shows, because there's always this feeling that if you, like, commit to one thing, that it's great for the first few episodes, but it can get a little tedious, and I never wanted to ruin my my feelings for towards the Twilight Zone, but that doesn't obviously stop us doing a double episode on Twilight Zone.
It's one of those things where, I forgot what I was going to say. Well, my number one observation is that it's going to strike, I think, anybody as, anybody who's a long-time listener, that what, it took them 31 episodes to finally get to the Twilight Zone?
We did in the first
episode. No, we did Outer Limits. We did Outer Limits. That's Outer Limits. Black and white Outer Limits.
Right. I don't understand why it's taken so long to get. I mean, yeah, we paid more visits to the Outer Limits than we have the Twilight Zone.
In all fairness, they were the two different incarnations of the Outer Limits.
That is true. So we've done if we combine it, just viewing like the Twilight Zone and its remake and the Outer Limits and its remake as their own thing, we've done three episodes of the Outer Limits so far, and now we're on to the Twilight Zone. I mean, for yourself, I mean, do you put one above the other? Because I've kind of always viewed them as being the same.
I wouldn't necessarily say they're exactly the same. They are, I think they hold a similar kind of position in people's minds. Certainly from a point where there was kind of like maybe like a golden age of anthology television that was kind of like genre in nature, because you had Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, Thriller with Boris Karloff, which I watched a marathon of maybe about a month ago over here. And that was some good stuff. And plus, I love Boris Karloff, like any sane human being does. One Step Beyond all kind of came from this era. So it was kind of like a golden age of this kind of thing. Outer Limits, I always tend to think of more as kind of like more horror or sci-fi horror oriented in its first season and more science fiction oriented in its second season, whereas the Twilight Zone, I always thought was, with the occasional outlier like Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, which, you know, having been written by Richard Matheson, really only exists with the, only really has the desire to make you shit your pants with fear. Really, there is kind of like, and particularly with the Rod Serling penned episodes of Twilight Zone, there's a very strong moral dimension. He's very much doing, and this is really evident in the two episodes that we've chosen to do here today, the moral fable aspect, or the social commentary aspect. I think it's, for the most part, I tend to think that from having seen as much, and I'm pretty familiar with the first couple seasons. There's so many episodes of the original series, and also keeping in mind that the series has been rebooted twice and is about to be rebooted a third time by Jordan Peele. I'm pretty familiar, but I think there's something like just even between those four seasons, there's a lot of episodes. But the ones I always tend to think of as being the archetypal, the Twilight Zone episodes are not necessarily like Nightmare at 20,000 Feet or The Invaders, the one that seems to be the work more on the scary end, but the ones that have, the ones like Time Enough at Last, those are the ones I tend to think of being. They have that fantastic element. They have that genre element. But Serling is not writing that kind of thing for its own sake in the way that I feel Joseph Stefano and his writers for the first season of The Outer Limits were doing. Not that The Outer Limits was completely immune to... even in its first season, it completely immune to social commentary either. And one of these days, I'd really kind of like to go back and take a look at an episode from the first season, like Architects of Fear, or I think it's called The Invisibles. But there's an episode of The Outer Limits in which Earth is being invaded by evil alien rocks, and I don't think that's something that would have been done on the Twilight Zone. I think the difference, I think that's really the difference between the two of them. I think that the Outer Limits was doing genre for its own sake, whereas I think Rod Serling was really into the idea of doing genre stories as metaphors, as fables, as social commentary. And I think that in many ways, that very well could be why Twilight Zone seems to be a bit better remembered than The Outer Limits.
Okay. Both shows I came to after their sort of run, so I was like picking them up on VHS tapes and just generally through tape trading where I could get other episodes. Cause it was always one of those shows that your parents would say about, to you about like episodes of Twilight Zone, and it was always in the cult sort of spectrum, and I remember like those sort of early days when you'd like hear about these episodes of the show, and your dad said you'd pick up bits and pieces, but the only sort of access I had would be like if there would be episodes like randomly shown on like the BBC or whatever, and closest we ever sort of got was the Outer Limits reboot series. So that's why I've always sort of put the two, and the other reason being that when I look at the other anthology shows, there was always this clear sort of definition of what they are, like Black Mirror's like technology based, Tales from the Dark Side and Tales from the Crypt, they're horror based, they're very sort of clear in their sort of distinction, whereas Outer Limits and Twilight Zone, they sort of had that sort of fable aspect, the twist, and as I said, I can see what you're obviously saying, where with Outer Limits, obviously went off on a slant more towards the horror and sci-fi. It just, when I was looking at these sort of stories, they always felt very similar in sort of tone to what we got with the Twilight Zone. But I know we've obviously had Thanksgiving recently and everyone got very excited about Turkey Day, so binge watching MST3K episodes. But I think if anything, if I'm going to binge any show, Twilight Zone would be the one I would want to watch. I mean, just sitting down to do the tapes this week, cause, I mean, the episodes we're looking at this week, we've been, they're both considered in the top 10 of most Peter Wolf's list when they do a list of top episodes of the Twilight Zone, and that's either Beholder and the Monsters Are Due on May.
It's interesting. I hate to interrupt you, but it's rather interesting, I think, because we had a quick discussion about which ones did you want to do for the next episode, and you said Monsters Are Due on Maple Street, and I was like, you bastard, that was my pick.
Yeah. But then it was so like, oh, I would. He's like, fine, I'll go and do either poetry. So like, well, that's my backup.
It's like, fine. If I have to watch, because it's my all time, the one that has had the all time, and I think I've alluded to this before. The one that's had the most visceral effect on me is Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. But I wanted to go into one of the more thoughtful ones, and those are the two that really kind of rise right up to the top. So that, I think, really kind of tells you exactly kind of where, like, the conventional wisdom of what the best Twilight Zones are, and how, you know, the fan base and even the casual fans, you know, the people that may not know every single episode or be able to give you every piece of minutia about every single episode will say, oh yeah, the one with you know, the paranoia one, or the one where they're trying to fix the girl that turns out to be beautiful, you know. Those are, in many ways, I think we're looking right now at the kind of like the archetypal Twilight Zones. You know, they have the science fiction or horror aspect. They have the social commentary. They've got the O. Henry twist at the end. This is the sort of stuff that Rod Serling did very, very well.
And and I think when we obviously get into these episodes, I think it's going to be pretty clear. I mean, these are stories that they stand up. There's no sort of dating these stories. These are like real classic sort of storytelling, and everything holds up. I mean, you could redo these episodes like today. Like if Jordan Peele decides, oh, I'm going to go and remake a bunch of classic Twilight Zone episodes, you know, just to give that little nod to the original series. And he could take these two episodes, remake them today with like modern effects, modern budget, and they would just still be as effective now as they were back in the 60s.
For the ill-fated 2003 reboot, the one that was narrated by Forrest Whitaker, they did a remake of Eye of the Beholder, which is on YouTube, and I was just kind of flipping through it, skimming through it, and they barely changed the dialogue. You know, it's not a shot-for-shot remake of the original episode, but by any stretch of the imagination, but it's like they, in most cases, didn't even bother changing the dialogue. That's how timeless this is.
I mean, they also remade Monsters, Joe Maple Street, in that same series. Uh-huh. That's a whole new other episode, because you've got Forrest Whitaker sneaking around this pure white suburban neighborhood.
Right.
So I'm sure that was a whole different scary situation for those guys.
Yeah.
I think we'll touch on that obviously a bit later when we obviously get onto the episodes. But we're talking about things that have been holding our interest. What have you been watching recently?
Well, I am insane with Glee right now. Two of my favorite things have been combined. AMC has combined two of my favorite things in the world. Right now, or I think they actually just finished airing it, there is a 6-part miniseries adaptation of one of my favorite authors, Jean Le Carré's novel, The Little Drummer Girl. Directed all 6 episodes, Park Chan-wook.
Oh, now that's an interesting twist.
Yep. And it is amazing. Amazing period espionage drama. Love it. I've watched the first 4 episodes. I got to watch the last 2. Michael Shannon, Alexander Skarsgård, and a British actress, I understand she's a little bit more known in Britain. This is the first I've heard of her. Florence Pugh. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Pugh. And I guess Charles Dance, Tywin Lannister himself, is going to be in here at some point. And Sam Troughton had a role, and somewhere is Jeremy Irons' son, Max. It is amazing. There has been, I think, most of Lacara's, the more recent kind of spate of Lacara adaptations, have been fairly good. I liked The Constant Gardener. I really, really liked the adaptation that Thomas Alfredson did of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy some years back with Gary Oldman, Benedict Cumberbatch, Colin Firth, Toby Jones, Kieran, I cannot remember the guy's last name, but you know who I'm talking about. Mance Rayder from Game of Thrones again. Kieran, I know it's Kieran Hines. But this just has, you know, it's got lovely period goodness. It's got this, I'm just really fascinated kind of like by the Cold War, particularly like in Europe in the 70s, continental Europe, where you had all these kind of, you had this kind of like, particularly like in the countries butting up on the Eastern Bloc, there's this sort of weird sort of, I'm not entirely sure what kind of, I wasn't really sure entirely how to phrase it, but there was, I was reading through, of all things, a biography, or an autobiography of one of the members of the German band Kraftwerk, and one of the things he was talking about was basically how he was the, basically how one of the things that they had in common was that they were the children of basically the Nazi generation. They were literally the children of literal Nazis. Not necessarily, you know, the ones behind everything, but I mean, people, you know, they were the children of people who were men who were cogs in the Nazi machine. And there is just something I think about the sort of Europe in the 70s, Germany in the 70s, France in the 70s, that I think kind of like the best, I think, Cold War period pieces. Another one that takes place in that era that I particularly love is the mini series on the mini series Carlos the Jackal. Okay. Edgar Ramirez as Carlos. That really paints Carlos the Jackal as this sort of he was the terrorist who couldn't shoot straight. And anything he managed really to do was almost completely by accident because he was just such a bumbling idiot. Which is really not how we think of him at all. But it really kind of captures that best, like that kind of like feel that I'm looking for from something here. Like you have, it's not James Bond style spy work. There are explosions. There are car chases. There is a lot of suspense, a lot of intrigue, but there's also a lot of, there's a lot of great character actors using accents, talking about, you know, ends be, and, you know, means to an end and all that lovely stuff. And where are the moral lines and should we be doing this? And are we white or are we wrong? You know, and that, you know, it's like watching like, you know, like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy or Munich, just spread across six episodes. And like I said, some brilliant, brilliant directorial work from Park Chan-wook. The sort of thing I would necessarily associate with him, but then again, it's not something I like what I've seen of his stuff, but I have to dig in and see more because I've never seen stuff like I've seen Old Boy and I've seen The Handmaiden. I may have seen one more, but I've never seen like the one that I know that you have talked me up on more than one occasion is Sympathy for Lady Vengeance. Yeah. I know you're a big fan of that. And that's one I got to do at some point.
Park Chan-wook, I'm a huge fan of. I mean, the whole Vengeance trilogy is really fantastic. And again, this is a trilogy in a very sort of Asian sense in the fact that it's recurring themes and ideas rather than characters.
Right.
So it starts with Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, goes into Old Boy, and then we have end with Lady Vengeance. Lady Vengeance, I feel, is the best of the three, although most people will say Old Boy is, but, you know, they're entitled to their opinion. But Park Chan-wook, he makes violence look beautiful. He has done some lighter fare. I mean, Joint Security Area is really a very underrated movie about this friendship formed between the guards on the Joint Security Area, so the line between North and South Korea. That's a really fascinating film, and the film made for his daughter, I'm a Cyborg, But I'm Okay, about a woman who thinks she's a cyborg, and is sent to a mental institute where she forms this friendship/relationship with a guy who feels he can steal the souls and special abilities of the other inmates. That's a really charming, charming movie. And obviously when he came into the States, he did Stoker, which was just wonderful, and I didn't think that the lead actor from Prison Break was capable of writing a script that good, but apparently he was, so... yeah, definitely. I don't think you can go wrong with the Patrick Wilson filmography. I think it's just, from top to bottom, it's just really, really, really cool. So, yeah, definitely deep.
Oh, yeah. And it's I'm just so stoked about it. It's got me more excited about... It's I think, the thing on TV, the TV thing that's had me the most excited recently. And there's been quite a lot of stuff to be... that's been really, really fun. So there's that. The latest season of Always Sunny in Philadelphia ended a few weeks ago.
I'm really jealous because Stephen over on the Asian Cinema Film Club, he just keeps telling me about how good it is.
Yeah.
And it's really annoying. It's like, you bastard, how am I supposed to watch it? I haven't got the links you guys.
Yeah, there are a couple of absolute all-time greats in the new season. I'm just really, and again, maybe not as, well, I guess it is, I guess the finale is mind blowing in not necessarily the way that the previous season finale was mind blowing, but this one, I don't even know how to explain it, but it's got some, you know, it's got a great, it's great for, the character it focuses on. Let's just say.
Isn't that the interpretive dance one?
Pardon?
Is that the interpretive dance
one? It is the interpretive dance one.
I keep hearing very mixed reviews about this, but I'm kind of intrigued to see how they do that. But who'd have thought they'd be able to pull off a musical episode?
The thing about it that really gets me is that there, it is a very bleak, cynical, acerbic show. But every so often, it's able to kind of pull off this weird kind of poignancy, which is, I think, all the more effective because it is normally so cynical, acerbic, whatever. And there's this one moment that damn near had me in tears earlier on in the series run, the episode where Sweet Dee gives birth. And they're playing, they're doing this whole thing at the towards the end of the episode, and they're using on the soundtrack, they're using Kate Bush's This Woman's Work as the set to it. And I was just like, wow, this is a sort of emotional depth. Or I don't know if I would necessarily say emotional depth, but this is sort of like this is not necessarily something that you really think of as being some in Sonny's wheelhouse. And yet it was able to pull it off, and it's kind of pulled that sort of thing off again. Nice. So what else? So that's done for the year. Doctor Who, the Jodie Whittaker era is continuing in earnest.
With weaponized bubble wrap.
Bubble wrap. I haven't really been able to, because of various family things, I haven't really been able to watch that episode. And I think I'm missing tonight's episode. I mean, I had it on in the background last Sunday, so I kind of know, I have a kind of broad idea of what happens in it, but I actually have to sit down and like watch it and like pay attention to it because I didn't do that last time, last week. The problem with Doctor Who this season is that, and I think this is Chris Chibnall as a writer. Chris Chibnall, with this, he's got a great cast, and that does include Bradley Walsh. And I know, I think it was last episode. Did it actually go into the episode, or was it off recording our discussion of what's the deal with Bradley Walsh?
No, we talked about in the show. I mean, the confusion over what Bradley Walsh is, whether he's a serious actor, whether he's a comedic actor, because he plays both fields, and yes, he can play, he's perfectly capable of doing both. I think a lot of people will see him as a comedic actor and a serious one. He's not pulled that Robin Williams trick of being able to flick the switch, so it's like, hey, look, I'm the funny guy. No, wait, here, I'm the fucking scary guy, which Robin Williams did so well. I've always said Robin Williams did crazy real
things. Yes.
And Bradley Walsh, serious? I don't know. he's enjoyable to watch as a serious actor. I just constantly find myself waiting for the punchline.
Yeah, it's, and I mean, his character on Doctor Who, this is not like the difference between the, and I, or at least I'm assuming what I've heard of Bradley Walsh, because I don't know any, I've never seen him before this. You know, this is not like, from what I can tell, it's not the difference between Robin Williams in Mork and Mindy and Robin Williams in 1 Hour Photo. You know, this is not any, this is not like a sort of dark, multidimensional character here. He is playing, he is basically playing a variation on, you know, the various themes, the very standard companion themes on Doctor Who, you know. But he's doing very well with what he's given. I like the cast. I think Jodie Whittaker's doing a bang up job with what she's given. I'm really impressed with her. She's won me over. Not that I ever thought that was going to be a problem. But I like the cast. I like the characters. The problem is, and this is, looking at Broadchurch, I can completely see where this is coming from. Broadchurch looks like a mystery, but it's not. Broadchurch is an examination. It's a series of character pieces disguised as a procedural, disguised as a mystery. It's not as much about who killed Danny Latimer as what effect Danny Latimer's murder had on the community. Chris Chibnall, I don't think, is as good at writing plot-driven stuff as he is at writing character-driven stuff, which is completely in line with his the episodes of he wrote the first two seasons of Torchwood, stinking like old fish. But you know, his episodes of Doctor Who this season have been, there's a lot of good ideas. Like I said, the characters for the most part very well cast. Chris Noth actually showed up from the Law and Order franchises and from Sex and the City. Showed up as basically playing kind of like a Donald Trump analog. But I think the characterization is strong. I think the acting is strong. There's definitely a cinematic element to the visual sense that I think has been, that I think is kind of new. I think they're making it more and look more and more cinematic. But it just seems like every episode, it's just badly, he's not pacing them right. He spends too much time, and I think a lot of this stuff is just, you know, we've got a really, really packed TARDIS now. You know, we've got a Doctor and three companions, and that's something we've not really seen since the Davison era. You know, it's just that he's having, number one, he's having a hard time cycling through all the characters and making sure all the characters have things to do. And the pacing is really off. Like the first few episodes were like the sauntering along and just kind of, you know, introducing themes and introducing characters. And then the last 10 minutes is, oh my God, we got to come to some sort of resolution. We got to, blah, 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 you know, and yeah. So far, you know, Chibnall wrote, I think, there's 10 episodes this year, and I think he wrote or co-wrote all of the first five. So the thing when they came to episode six was that, you know, as of episode six, which is really kind of where I left off, which is in the two episodes that were the best were the ones, one of which he wasn't sole writer, he co-wrote, and one, the other one, he didn't have a writing credit at all. Those were the episodes about, no, they were also the historical ones. There was one about Rosa Parks, which was really good and starred, of all the people in the universe that could have starred, it starred, the villain of the week was Josh Bowman, who played, he was on Revenge. He was, Madeline Stowe's son on Revenge, the one that, Emily Van Camp married and had that whole thing with. Daniel, I think his name was. And the second one was the one that was about the partition of India and Pakistan. And those were, I think, probably genuinely all-time great episodes, or at least by New Who standards. You know, I'm not sure. I mean, even trying to go in and I think compare, I think it's kind of like a folly to try to sit here and try to compare New and even say, because you have these completely different set of expectations between the two series. But definitely, Rosa and the Demons of, I think, Punjab, are ones for the books for New Who. But I think he's just having a problem. He's struggling, I think, with plot driven. Chibnall is struggling with plot driven material. So that's Doctor Who. This Is Us is back on. It's just as emotionally manipulative as ever, and yet it's also somehow weirdly addictive. And then the other thing, which I am really kind of stoked about, and I've completed this, is the new season of Channel Zero, which is based on The Secret Door. And that's a very I don't really think it sticks the landing in the last two episodes, but it's just so weird and bizarre, and just has a lot of great visually. It's a lot of great stuff, and the wonderful thing about it is, if one thing you can tell if you're watching the new season of Channel Zero, if there's anybody in the cast you recognize, they will die within an episode or two. Spoilers, but it's like Greg Henry has all of one scene. I think Steven Weber has about five lines. I didn't even realize Barbara Crampton. I didn't even recognize Barbara Crampton. So those are what I've been jonesing on. So what about you?
It's a bit of a mixed bag. First off, you already mentioned about Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which obviously ties nicely because I've been obsessed with The Mick, which obviously features Sweet D from Always Sunny. A little disappointed on the last episode where you revealed it has been axed, because every episode I watch this show, it just keeps getting better. Uh-huh. Now they've, so I'm about 12 episodes in, and you can tell they've really figured out how to write this show, because it's just so sharp. And she's obviously playing a variation of Sweet D. It's almost like if she left the bar and decided to go and look after her lost sister's kids or something who happened to be rich, and she sponged off that lifestyle. It's the same sort of attitude that Sweet D has, where if I can sponge off a rich person's lifestyle, I'm going to do it. Like when she became the Sarah.
Right.
And she was like milking that rich couple. It's basically the same sort of concept. And they had a really great episode where she's organizing a birthday party for the youngest child, and they get this clown in who turns up and he looks like a complete junkie, and oh wait, he can like do magic tricks, and he's like fine. So he goes over into the bathroom to get ready, and they like wonder where this clown's got to, and they go in, and he's like in the bathtub completely naked, syringe in his arm, like completely OD'd. And we have this wonderful scene of her trying to revive this clown in the bathtub where these small children are onlooking. And she's there like pulling the tissues out of his mouth, and it's like, God, how long is this bloody thing? But I think I'm going to save that episode, not go into that episode too much, because I think I'm going to save it for a future episode, because it's just so sharp and just been an absolute wonderful series. And it's good to actually have a good sitcom at the moment, because at the moment I'm just sort of either watching shows because they're coming to an end, like Big Bang, or just watching a lot of sitcom repeats at the moment, so it's nice to have a new one.
Yeah.
On the Netflix side of things, I watched the Defiant Ones documentary series, the four-part series about Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine.
Pardon?
It's called The Defiant Ones. Jimmy Iovine, he sent Interscope Records. And Dr. Dre being...
That one.
Dr. Dre, legendary member of NWA and the guy who discovered that.
Yeah.
Really great series. Again, if you are obviously a fan of hip-hop music, you should know, if you know your history, you know the close connection between rock music and hip-hop. Uh-huh. So it's great the fact that you've got these two sort of titans. The two created Beats headphones, which they sold to Apple Music for like $3 billion in stock. making Dr. Dre the first billionaire hip-hop mogul.
Right.
And it's just basically about both of their careers from where they started, and with Lavone obviously starting off doing like records with like Bruce Springfield and he did Free Falling.
Tom Petty.
And Dr. Dre obviously coming up with NWA, yeah, and him going doing stuff with Suge Knight. It's a really in-depth series, goes into it, and they even like have little sidebars where they talk about like the big artists they brought in. So for Levine, it was like bringing Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails.
That's right. Yeah, because Iovine founded Interscope.
That's right.
Interscope. God. Yeah, I think Interscope bought TVT, TV Tunes, which was known almost entirely for the longest time before Pretty Hate Machine. They were TVT, stood for TV Tunes. They were entirely known for these compilations of TV theme songs that they would advertise on late night TV until Pretty Hate Machine came out. And then Lollapalooza, the first Lollapalooza of the tour happened, and that's what really broke Nine Inch Nails. And I think Interscope may have even bought TVT entirely just to get Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah, I mean, they did a deal where they pretty much brought them in under a co-producing deal because TVT had Nine Inch Nails, and they didn't know what the hell they were doing with them. And Levine obviously saw great potential in Nine Inch Nails. And he basically brought Trent Reznor. He was like, well, what do you want? And Reznor's like, well, I want to basically produce my album. I don't want any interference. He's like, done.
Yeah.
And he's like, I want to have my own label so I can bring in like little side projects. He's like, done.
Yeah.
Like, well, this is like the easiest song contract.
Yeah,
well,
don't give me any money. I'll finance everything. I don't want to owe you any money. I don't want you to owe me any money. I'll pay for my own videos. I'll pay for my own promotion.
And, yeah, I mean, Trent Reznor he's just a genius producer, you know, right? I mean, he obviously shows how he brings in Marilyn Manson, and they record, I believe, Portrait of a Manson Family in the Sharon Tate house.
Yep.
They would just randomly rent a house, and it's like, why is this house all gated up? It's like, oh, yeah, this is where the Manson murders happened. It's like, oh, right. Yeah, we'll take this place.
Back in the 90s, and they were the ones that I just think that one of the things just so hilarious was that they were Coil. Of all the bands in the world, Coil had a major label contract. They never released an album on Nothing Records, but they were signed to Nothing Records, and they were supposed to release something through them. That is the thing that always just if there had ever been a major label Coil release, it would have been through Nine Inch Nails. You know, yeah, and just that whole thing. I think Pop Lead itself, I think the Poppies were also on Nothing.
I know that Traffic Girls, so they brought in now, because they brought in Primus, was another of Ivone's sort of science. And I think, if anything, this miniseries is a great pairing with Super Schmint, about the manager of Alice Cooper.
Okay.
Which we've talked about in the past, and he's another guy. Because just when you talk about how he talks and how Jimmy Iovine talks, they're cut from the same
place. Uh-huh.
Shep Gordon, that's who the focus of Super Schmint is. Super Schmint's great documentary as well, directed by Mike Myers. Super Schmint, if you're not obviously aware...
Oh, my God! Shep Gordon produced... He produced horror movies. He produced John Carpenter movies.
Yeah. He had his fingers in many, many pies. I mean, he's the guy responsible for Celebrity Chefs.
Uh-huh.
When he came into Hollywood and he was hanging around the pool with Janis Joplin, Alice Cooper, and Jimi Hendrix, and they needed someone to represent them as magic. And he was at this point working as a drug dealer. And they were like, you're Jewish, you do. so suddenly now he's a manager. Never been a manager of anything in his life. And now he's producing these three major acts. But yeah, Alice Cooper's Concert in London wasn't sent out, so he pays a lorry with a big billboard on the side to break down in Piccadilly Circus. And what do you know? Alice Cooper's show signs out and sells out the very same night. But Super Shrent is a really, really cool documentary, and one that I would really recommend pairing with Devon. So plenty to definitely check out there. The other thing which has always been of my interest has been binging a little bit on the anime side. First off being Akeem Ga Kill. If you're obviously worried about the end of Game of Thrones coming up and want something similar, then I would recommend checking this out. This is a show which has been described as many as the anime version of Game of Thrones, mainly because if you get attached to any character, they will die. And horribly. Basically, the show itself follows this young boy called Tatsumi, who is a young villager, and he heads to the capital city to raise money for his village, only to discover that the capital is run by this corrupt government. And he joins an assassin group known as Night Raid to basically try to spark a revolution to topple the government. And all of them are armed with these fantastical weapons called Imperial Arms, and they go up against their counterparts known as the Jaegers. The show is packed full of, like, so much violence and humor. It's just a really fun series to breeze through at 24 episodes, and yeah, I had an absolute blast with this series, and it's probably one of my highlights of the year as far as my anime viewing goes. On the fantasy side of things is a new one for this season, and that's Goblin Slayer. This show has already received a lot of controversy because of the first episode featuring an element of sexual violence, so if that's not your thing, skip the first episode and pick up episode 2. But this is based on the manga by Kurase. And again, it's just a really fun, fast-paced show. If you grew up playing like D&D or Palladium, those sort of fantasy games, you really get a kick out of it, because Goblin Slayer is basically this knight who, his sister was attacked and killed by goblins when they were younger, and he's now vowed revenge, so all he cares about is killing goblins. And in this world, goblins are not just these throwaway beasts, as many people view them as. They're these really dangerous beasts that have to be completely crushed, because otherwise, if they get out of hand, they're just going to cause havoc in the local sort of population. But yeah, I think if you're looking for a fun fantasy show, then Goblin Slayer is definitely worth checking out.
Young Priestess Jones, a group of rookie adventurers who decide to rave a cave infested with goblins. Things quickly go awry when the inexperienced party is ambushed by goblins, resulting in all of them, save for the princess, being killed, raped, or captured.
Oh yeah, it goes south real
all
quick.
All right.
I mean, we're 10 minutes in this cave, and it's like, oh, and our main hero guy's been mobbed by 7 goblins and being hacked to death. It's like, oh, this isn't going the way we planned it.
I'm sensing we're going to be doing this at some point in the future.
It's a 12-episode season at the moment. When you look at it, it's very traditional sort of fantasy setup. You've obviously got the Heroic Knight Goblin Slayer, which, if you think that's a stupid name, let's not just don't forget that in Berserk, the lead guy was called Guts. So in anime terms, it's not that bad. And, you know, in his party, he's got the elf, and he's got the dwarf who bicker with each other, and he's got the lizard man who really likes cheese.
it's anime. You have to have a lizard guy who really likes cheese.
Well, they're trading. They're sitting around the campfire, and they're trading items. So, like, the dwarf has got his fire wine, and the elf has got her thing, and the goblin slayer's, like, produced this cheese, and the lizard man's never seen cheese before because he's not from a farming town, and he just gets very excited about cheese, and now since that moment, every chance he gets, he just wants cheese. So.
Cheese anime.
Yeah, it's a really, really cool show. Again, it's if you just want to see thousands of goblins being slaughtered horribly, and don't mind a bit of anime violence, it's a good show.
And raping people, apparently.
Yes, there is an unfair sceptre. I mean, this is the problem with that, because that one scene.
Yeah.
And it's not as graphic as, like, Legend of the Overfiend or anything.
I should hope not. I can definitely tell that they're playing with traditional fantasy tropes here, because in episode 9 is apparently actually named There and Back Again.
I just got to say, though, but, I mean, everyone's like, oh, goblins, they're not dangerous. When I played D&D, I lost a character to bloody goblins. So don't tell me goblins ain't dangerous.
Yeah, goblins aren't. Goblins are especially dangerous, particularly when your DM is insisting you kill every goddamn one of them, and not just allowing you to slice through them like a hot knife through butter.
There's a reason they're called sneaky. So.
That's actually what they're called. That's actually their creature type in the monster manual. Goblin type. Sneaky gits.
Damn right. but yeah. I mean, that pretty much wraps it up at the moment. I've got a couple of other shows that I'm still watching at the moment, which we'll talk about in the next episode. Because I started Garen Roper, which is kind of like Ace Attorney meets Batman.
The sum total of my exposure to Ace Attorney is the one where they take the old Frantics sketch boot to the head, and okay. They sync it to Ace Attorney.
This is a show which is
hilarious. I now cannot think of Ace Attorney without thinking of that character with the big hair singing boot to the head and pointing it at somebody, and that character then getting a boot to the head. Another one for Jenny and the Wimp.
Yeah, it's basically you have a bunch of anime tropes who are thrown in together in this school that they can't escape from, and basically the various murders happen throughout, and they have to hold trials to figure out which of them committed the murders, with the guilty party getting sentenced to some horrible theatrical death, and all this has been orchestrated by a demonic teddy bear. Okay. So,
it's cool. Yeah.
I think that, as I said, that's what's currently been holding my interest. As I said, I'm just on a real anime kick at the moment, and it's just, as I said, you can get these shows on Crunchyroll or Funimation, depending on where you want, or you can obviously get them for the usual sources. So they're out there to enjoy. And I think at this point, we'll put the best off going on to the first of our episodes. Now, if you're good to move on.
Let's do that.
Cool. Let's start with Eye the Beholder, because I feel that of the two, this is the quickest one sort of been through. Now, if you're obviously not familiar with this episode, it basically has this woman called Janet Tyler. Now, she's basically undergone the instant treatments to try and improve her appearance so she looks normal. And she's currently on an 11th treatment, which in this society is like the maximum number you're legally allowed to have. And for the most part of the episode, she's completely bandaged. She looks like the chick from Goodnight Mommy.
Yeah.
If you saw that.
Oh, album. Yeah. And one of my favorites of recent years,
Yeah, I mean, this is a real credit to Maxi Drew, who plays Janet.
I want to point out the voice of Janet. We'll get to the face of Janet in a minute here.
Because I mean, she's doing all this completely bandaged. I mean, there's not like you can see her face or anything. She's like full bandage head here. So everything she's doing is she's emoting through her voice, and it's an incredible performance. And yes, at the same time, all the doctors and nurses, we never see their faces either. They're always behind screens or we're shot behind the heads. Also, got love 1960s, so doctors smoke, which is always fun to see. But basically, Janet is getting more and more distraught as the episode goes on, because she wants the bandages off, and the doctors are basically saying, no, we've got to keep them on. We're not sure how the procedure's gone, and we can't guarantee that it's gonna work. And through the course of the episode, we're hearing about her story around the fact that she like grew up and she felt that she didn't want to be beautiful. She just wanted to be normal. You know, she doesn't want to fit in with the rest of the society, which is perfectly understandable. And I mean, once the bandages come off, she's a beautiful woman.
She's,
and you think
specifically, she's Donna Douglas, Ellie Mae Clampett from the Beverly Hillbillies.
So, I mean, as I said, us, the viewer, and, I mean, before we even get to this, I mean, this is one of those rare occasions where Rod Sterling actually interjects. We have the opening, and then Rod Sterling interjects to say, you know, this is the situation here, you know, you've got to be prepared for what's underneath these bandages. And we built up in my mind that it's going to be something horrific that's under these bandages. I mean, I think anyone who've watched anything from this period knows that anyone who's bandages the way that she is in this, it's nothing good that's going to be underneath those bandages. You know, we're expecting, like, a bug-eyed monster or horrific burns where something like the eyes are out of face chick. I don't know what you expect. I mean, Lackey, I mean, when you saw this episode, I mean, what was your sort of thoughts as what's underneath those bandages?
Yeah, see, the kind of the problem about this episode for me was that I had a traumatic experience when I was 10 with the Twilight Zone. I wanted to stay up late one night, and I wanted to watch Twilight Zone. Back in the 80s, and even through the 90s, there was literally, in just about every TV market in America, ran some channel. At least one channel ran a Twilight Zone at like 10 at night. Then my parents let me stay up till 10 o'clock to watch an episode of the Twilight Zone. And then that episode turned out to be Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. And that fucking gremlin. I'm 40. I'm almost 45. I'm going to be 45 in less than a month. And I still have problems looking at still pictures from that episode. As much as that fucking gremlin looks like a guy wearing a bad fright mask and a bunch of carpet remnants, it's the sort of thing that really just – it really freaked me out like nothing had ever freaked me out before. And I wouldn't touch the Twilight Zone after that for years and years. So it turns out that I'm not entirely sure when I first saw this episode, but I'm absolutely certain that I knew the twist, having read about it in Stephen King's book Danse Macabre. So I'm pretty sure that I actually knew what the twist was. And I'm, you know, I think knowing what we do now, I think, and when I say we, I don't mean me or me and you. I mean, like, the viewers in general, if they haven't seen this, you kind of get the feeling that, you know, the way things go, you kind of get the feeling that she's not necessarily going to be ugly, and there's going to be some sort of twist around it. It's like a movie done about 15 years ago that used a similar twist to this very well. Was a movie called The Hamiltons, which is about a family of vampires. And they keep talking about there's this one member of the family that we only hear about, we never see, and he lives in the basement, and they never show him. And they keep building up to it, and about halfway through the movie, I'm thinking, he's just a kid. He's not going to be freakishly deformed, or he's not going to be a werewolf or anything like that. He's going to be a regular kid, which is really kind of like the most frightening thing the film could do at that point, is just basically say and present the monster, and it says, okay, here's the monster. The monster's a kid, ordinary looking kid. And that, I think, I've sort of wired myself to start looking for all these little key elements that kind of will tell me what the twist is. You know, so about 2 or 3 minutes into it, I'm basically noticing, okay, here are all the subconscious cues that Sterling and the director of the episode are using to basically say, this is not going to turn out how you think it's going to turn out. They're not going to unwrap her. She's not going to be some hideous beasts. It's going to be like that if you've ever seen the list of Southern Gothic tropes, every Southern Gothic novel ever. Old Pap, nobody takes old Pap seriously because of the deformity, but I say it's you all what has the deformity in your souls. You kind of realize that that's where it's going. And how they do it, I think, is from a visual standpoint, is absolutely brilliant, because it has a very noirish feel to it. It's got all these shadows and, dim lighting. And I think just visually, it's from from an era of television which is really not known for its directorial flair. You know, I particularly there's the scene where the doctor and the two nurses are speaking at the nurses' station outside, and they're talking about Janet Tyler. And this is the other thing I think that this episode does, which is an absolute stroke of genius from the writing point of view, is it basically starts off letting you think that this is happening in an ordinary, this is like an ordinary thing, that this is happening just out in the real world. Because there's a second layer here. I mean, everybody knows the twist that, oh, and in the end, it's that the person who thinks she's ugly is actually beautiful, and it's everybody else that's ugly. And there's a kind of a layer which I don't think really gets talked about a whole lot when it comes to this episode. This is also the point where you start getting these little hints of dystopianism in the in kind of thing. The other thing is, well, 11 surgeries is what the state only will what the state will allow is another thing where this is actually taking place in. You know, kind of like a not only the science fiction conceit. It's not that the twist is the only science fiction conceit. It's taking place in this sort of totalitarian setting, where this is punctuated by having a television broadcast from the quote unquote leader, kind of punctuate the later scenes. He's making this sort of political broadcast, and he's talking about how, you know, we have to have norms and we have to conform to them, and we have to cut the ugly things out like a cancer, which gives us, I mean, it's on top of that, it gives us a little bit more of a thing than just, you know, a literal portrayal of beauty really is in the eye of the beholder. It's you know, it can stand for any kind of thing that you kind of want to in terms of separating, like, you know, to turn a noun into a verb here, of othering. You know, we're going to take a group of people and we're going to turn them into the other. You know, so this is a this is, and I have no doubt this is what Serling meant at the time, because Janet Tyler even mentioned segregation at the beginning, you know, towards the beginning. You know, when they talk about, you know, if this doesn't work, then there's a place that we can send you where you'll be with your own kind. Hint, hint, hint.
And yeah, the fact they're going to put
segregation, which is basically makes this a civil rights metaphor, and that is one of the big grindstones, axes, I guess, axes that Serling likes to set to the grindstone. The idea of civil rights and which was, again, considering this episode would have been 60 or 61, would have been very, very, very timely. But it's also kind of the thing that also, particularly in American society, and I guess there's a lot of I assume there's a lot of othering and scapegoating going on in Britain as well. So this probably hits you as well with things where right now we're going through in America, we're going through this whole thing with we have a goblin-faced monster occupying the White House, and he's always going on about, you know, how we have to keep this such and such a undesirable group of people out of our country. You know, so it gives it a kind of like the timeless thing, because apparently the one thing that we'll never, ever fucking do as human beings, you know, is be able to live next door to anybody who ever looks any kind of slightly different than us, without it turning it into a gigantic fucking production. But anyway, so yeah, you have these kind of hints early on. I think I even missed saying what the hint was when they're talking at the nurse's station, where they only refer to her by her. They don't call her, you know, Miss Tyler. They call her like room 207 or whatever, the girl woman in 207, Miss 207, where it's like, again, that's kind of like a very 60s identifier in the 60s and the 70s, particularly in America, but also in Britain. It's you know, the prisoner type thing, referring to somebody by a number instead of by a name. You know, we know her name's Janet Tyler, but when they're away from her, they only refer to her by the room number. And And that, I think, that's, I think, the whole totalitarian aspect, which, you know, I think it makes it a civil rights metaphor and also a Nazi metaphor. That's another kind of, again, we're talking about the early 60s here. So this is, you know, World War II is something that is not, you know, even 20 years in the past. And it more than there are episodes of The Twilight Zone also dealing with Nazi history. And that is, I think, a bit chunk of the episode that really is talked about a whole lot. And I think that was kind of rambling a bit. But anyway, the point is that there's like that scene, to go back to that scene where they go and they're always like over people's shoulders and then back and then pan up and then pan back. I just love how the camera, the director does that. Unfortunately, we have the illusion marred a little bit at the beginning by, one of the, nurses is shown in very, 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 very low. It's supposed to be very, very low light, but we can see she doesn't have any makeup on. So if you know what you're looking for, but anyway, so that's my aimless, multifaceted thing.
It's great. I mean, I love the whole episode, the big reveal. I mean, I unlike yourself, I did assume that she was going to be beautiful when we take the bandages off here. And I think if you haven't guessed already, we are going to be including some spoilers these episodes. So just warning ahead, especially for the next one we're going to be discussing after the break.
Spoilers for 60 early episodes of television here.
I know, but not if, you know, some people yes, are that's still very coming true. That's very true. So. And again, this is the reason we chose the two episodes we did, because they've not been parodied or remade, like, in public culture, like the way that...
The Third Man is the one that always comes to mind. Particularly, I think it's the one, I think the Simpsons did it with Kang and Kodos, where it's like, oh, it's the Third Man. It's a cookbook. No, it's not. Something like that. I think they did something like that. But yeah.
They also did the one where Bart's able to change the world with his mind.
Oh, yeah. The Good Day one. Yeah. It's a real good day. Another favorite of mine.
And I think there's other episodes which are just like very much in the public sort of consciousness. And I think these two episodes aren't so much. So the fact you can watch them and enjoy the twist, unless you're lucky and able to see things coming a mile off. As I said, I when she takes the bandages off, I thought, oh, we've got to get some really nasty here. And then, wait a minute, she's pretty, but in this world, she's not. And just the way they play the episode, I mean, so perfectly tonally. The fact that, you know, she's clearly upset. She doesn't look like these other people, that she's viewed as this twisted, pitiful lump of flesh in this society, because she doesn't have what they consider to be these traits of beauty. And the fact that, you know, she's going to be packed off to the ghetto now because she can't have any more treatment. She's basically stuck looking like this beautiful woman, and she's taken off by at the end of the episode by this equally handsome looking man to obviously live out her days in the ghetto. And the fact she's so determined to be part of society, she's like, I can wear a mask, I can do some like menial job where nobody would see me and I wouldn't harass anyone. And they're like, no, you look the way you are, you're getting sent off to the ghetto. you don't get a say in this is the way society works. And I think it was just, it was just a really fun twist, and I think this is one of the things I liked about Twilight. The fact that it is these fun little twists, and these where you think you got it worked out, and then it just like pulls the carpet from under your feet in those sort of moments. And I think it's the sort of thing that M. Night Shyamalan's tried to make a career out and failed miserably at doing. And even at the end of the episode, we get like a little tease of what's coming up next, and it's like what's in there, and he's got a little fortune box, and it's sort of like, well, what's going to be with this box? I mean, this is like a box of predictions from hell. Where do we go with this box? And it kind of like makes you want to see what happens in the next episode. And I think, and the fact that, I mean, these are the 30-minute episodes, so it's real tight writing. It's no fat to these episodes at all.
It's very. I was really kind of surprised how quickly this episode went.
And it feels like you're getting more than 30 minutes
of material.
like the depth of these characters and what they establish for this conversation. And again, she's got, you can't see her face at all for Alice. This is a woman in a bandaged head. Truly emoting like her life depends on it, and selling this character with such emotion and feeling that even before you see it without the bandages on, you truly feel for this woman's plight. I mean, you know, she's not doing this for vanity reasons. She's just doing it because she just wants to be normal, and that's just stressed time and time again by the episode.
It's a very efficient piece of world building where you get, you know, and again, I'm not trying to say that I'm sitting here. It's like, yes, I can see every twist coming a mile away. But the point is, I knew what the twist was. So I'm looking for the hints that the twist is coming. And it's like, well, there's definitely something fishy about the fact that we never see the doctor's faces. You know, if it were just that there was something wrong with her, if, you know, you're going to unwrap her face and, you know, she's, you know, like, you're going to get something that's like a cross between, you know, an unmasked Darth Vader and Cthulhu, you know, then that's one thing. But it's like, there's just something with all this low light and all the fact that nobody's ever seen up close. It's like, you know, except for that one kind of bungled shot at the beginning. But even when they do the beginning of the leader's political broadcast, you know, if you squint really hard and put your face right up to the screen, you can see that the actor is wearing the makeup. But the way that they shoot it, where he's so far back and they make it look like this Leni Riefenstahl type thing, you know. Yeah. But he's so far back, and the picture quality is so 1960 that he just looks like kind of an ugly looking guy, but not like necessarily like with the upturned pig snout nose and the snarly lip. You know, but it's just the fact that they're doing all that and these, and like I said, it's just, it also gives it kind of like an aesthetic level that makes it look almost like film noir. You know, people are lighting cigarettes behind screens, and they're only ever seen in silhouette or in shadow. And I mean, it's just it's fun for the twist. It's fun to watch for the performances. All these people basically giving performances where you can never see their faces until the very end.
Yeah.
And it's just something that I think it's a perfect storm, and that it works in just about every level. You know, this is what the show was capable of doing when it was firing on all cylinders. It's not even just that it's an amazing story, which it is. It's just that, you know, Sterling's nailing every part of the, you know, how you build the world, how you immerse the world, how you immerse the viewer in the world, the aesthetics, the visual aesthetics, the makeup aesthetics. You know, they're doing, it's an amazing, you can watch it and get pleasure from it off of several different levels. And, you know, for something that, again, is almost a 60-year-old piece of television, and that you can watch it and you can enjoy it, and you don't really have to give it too many, you don't really have to modulate your expectations drastically. You know, you don't, I mean, yeah, sometimes the makeup isn't quite effective, and yes, sometimes the dialogue is kind of purple, but for you to, I mean, it's very rare to find something that really kind of continues to work on that level 60 years later, where you don't have to kind of, you don't find yourself constantly shifting back and saying, okay, this may not work entirely, but this would have been great back in 1960. You know, yeah, that's definitely. And I think that's why, you know, it's from a story point standpoint, it's the sort of thing that we remember the Twilight Zone doing best. Like I said, it's got the horror element, it's got the fantastic element, the element of fantasy or science fiction, what have you. It's also got the moral fable. It's a piece of social commentary. And, you know, we remember that, but it's got all the other production values going on. And that's why, you know, right along with the other episode we're doing, and To Serve Man, and, you know, Good Day and Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, it's why these are the episodes we remember, because it really is that friggin' amazing.
Good question. So, so, I mean, it's definitely a thumbs up for me for this episode. If I can see why people rate it so
high. Oh, yeah.
So. Anything else you want to talk about?
I think I've talked myself out on it. I don't think. Let's put it like this. I don't think if there's anything I'm going to be able to say that anybody's going to be able to follow. Which is not talking
Let's
about.
Go. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when you rejoin us, we'll be on Maple Street where the monsters are due.
Any moment now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we're going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com, or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
You're traveling through another dimension. A dimension not only of sight and sound, but of mind. A journey into a wondrous land whose boundaries are that of imagination. Your next stop, the Twilight Zone.
Maple Street, USA. Late summer. A tree-lined little world of front porch gliders, barbecues, the laughter of children, and the bell of the ice cream vendor. At the sound of the roar and the flash of light, it will be precisely 6:43 p.m. on Maple Street. This is Maple Street on a late Saturday afternoon. Maple Street in the last calm and reflective moment before the monsters came. And so opens the second episode of our selection site, The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street. This has to be, hands down, have the greatest opening and closing narration of any episode of Twilight Zone or Outer Limits that I've seen. I love the opening and closing of this episode so much. And this episode itself is, again, another top 10 episode. And it's really easy to see why, as this episode not only works as a TV episode, that you can have this and just playing the audio. So have it like a little audio play in the background if you're doing something, and it's still just as effective. The story itself is set on the town of Maple Street, and basically there is this roar and a flash of light, and soon all the residents discover the power's gone off, and it's wiped out everything. It's like an EMP pulse, basically. Cars don't work, phones are out, lawnmowers are not working, and basically, the residents all come together and they're trying to figure out what's happened. And through a series of events, paranoia soon starts creeping in amongst them as they believe that there's certain members amongst them who may not be what they seem. And this has all been sort of fueled by the local boy, Tommy, who, going off what he's read in the comic book, believes that this is all the signs of an alien invasion. But is it an alien invasion or is it just plain paranoia? Lakimi, what's your thoughts on The Monsters of Joe Maple?
Okay, so number one here, we are talking about my all-time favorite Twilight Zone episode.
Fantastic.
So we're going to – I'm going to be raving about this. So Rod Serling has a number of – he has a number of themes that he returns to over and over and over throughout throughout the run – throughout his run in the Twilight Zone. The one we've already we've already talked about, which is the dangers of the dangers involved with and the moral implications of scapegoating and quote unquote othering, we've already seen in Eye of the Beholder, and we're going to be seeing it again in this episode as well. The other two themes that he likes to deal with a lot. He likes to deal with the simplicity, what is kind of hiding underneath the simplicity of small town American life. And that's why this is called, Maple Street. Maple Street is almost the, to quote Sparks, it's a street named after a New England tree. In that it's one of these things, like, it's like, um, he chooses Maple Street for the same reason you have a Nightmare on Elm Street. You know, having a Nightmare on Madison Avenue doesn't really kind of get that small townishness quite right. That this is really kind of like a slice of, this is how this unnamed town, Maple Street and this unnamed town, is really kind of how we see those of us who did not grow up in the late 50s, early 60s, how we see in our minds, how we see small town America, suburban and really more suburban or exurban America. So we have that. And the other major theme, there's another episode that is almost exactly like this one that deals on the same theme. And the theme is the mob hysteria and mob rule. There's an episode called The Shelter, which has almost the exact same structure as Monsters Are Due in Maple Street. Instead of the meteor, you have what everybody thinks is a nuclear strike or an impending nuclear strike. And there's this whole fight over, there's like the one guy family on the block with a fallout shelter. And, they're having this whole thing, this whole examination, Serling then breaks into this examination on exactly how quickly, when you have a situation of paranoia and a situation of scapegoating, and how quickly, John and Jane Average will turn on their neighbors and friends. Even to the extent of just like at the climactic moment of The Monsters Are Due at Maple Street, where someone gets killed mistakenly over this thing that turns out is not exactly, what it seems. What you have is, in the in the shelter, you have, this whole thing going, people turning on each other, this nuclear strike, which, if I recall correctly, is a mistake, or it doesn't happen, or it's a glitch in the works. And this is what you have is, for over the course of half an hour in Monsters Are Due in Maple Street, you have a lot of arguments and people turning on each other that really would have pleased John Carpenter making the thing.
It definitely is like that.
Yeah. And it's got this, again, these are with people turning on each other and people saying, oh, you're with the aliens because I see you get up in the middle of the night and stare at the sky. No normal person gets up at 3 a.m. and stares at the sky, which is an amazingly weirdly specific thing, to kind of base one's idea of normality, normalcy on, and then people are like, well, you're in this, you're always in the basement doing something weird that you never talk about. What's going on with that? And people are just grasping at straws, just grasping at whatever they can to basically say, no, I'm not the monster. You've got to be the monster. Until the guy who sets off at the beginning to check the, to go over to the next block, and check to see if they've got power on the next block, comes back and, he gets shot by someone who thinks he's a monster. And of course, the final twist, that what all the aliens are doing, and the hilarious thing about it is that they're just basically, sinister looking humanoids in bizarre costumes. There's no makeup on display here like you see in Eye of the Beholder. They're just, people in futuristic alien uniforms. Yeah. They're saying, yeah, that's all we have to do. We just have to screw with their lights a little bit, screw with their power, and then they'll just all turn on each other. Oh, and are they like this everywhere? Oh, yeah, there's Maple Streets everywhere. We don't have to conquer them. We don't have to destroy them. All we have to do is screw with their perceptions and they'll destroy each other. Which is, it's just this amazing kind of little twist at the end, which just, just kind of like the way he twists that knife at the end, figuratively with that twist, it's like, oh yeah, we don't have to lift. All we have to do is turn their power on and off, and they'll do all the rest of the work for us. You know, it's just, it's masterful. It's just absolutely masterful. And it's just, oh, I just all the, oh, I, you know, and it just does seem so believable because it is, I mean, we know from our history that life, that this is something that was really actually going on in American history not too long. I mean, the Red Scare and the McCarthyism happened, you know, I don't remember exactly when in the 50s it happened, but it was in recent memory. And you know, people that, you know, particularly with the writers, the Hollywood, whatever, the writers who had been blacklisted. I mean, these were writers from, they were part of Rod Serling's generation of writers. And this was a very important kind of this sort of scapegoating and this whole saying, well, we can't prove you're kind of slightly a little bit dodgy here. So you've got to be in cahoots with whatever menace we've decided are the baddies that are seeking to infiltrate our society and destroy us from within. It's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers without the Body Snatchers.
Well, I mean, this is the whole plot of this film. I mean, as you said, I mean, it's got that undertone to the fear of the communism sneaking into America. And I mean, you can apply this to now our current situation. We have people who are afraid that Al Qaeda and terrorists and, you know, Mexican drug dealers are going to smuggle in the border. That we have this fear of being infiltrated. Uh-huh. And I think this is what it does so well. And this. Just from the start, you have this undertone of violence. Like we see the shot of the hammer,
right,
in the guy's belt. And while it's obviously in the plot, I think it was more just so we know it's the same guy when he gets shot at the end of the episode. But right when we see that hammer, it's sort of like this undertone of violence. It's underneath the surface. I mean, everyone's starting out civil, but soon the little details are going to start creeping up. It's sort of like, well, what are you? As you said, what are you doing? It's sort of like. Les, you just go out and stare at the sun. He's like, well, I'm an insomniac. And then he switches over. It's like, but Steve, you're building a radio in your basement. And again, that ties in really nice to that whole Red Scare idea. You know, the idea that the communists are on us and we've got some in a situation like in the Americans where they're running these covert operations in sleepy suburbia. And it was just the round robin, the fact that blame's constantly being passed from one person to the other. And it'd be like the most simplest thing that we set it off like, oh, wait a minute, your car works. Nobody else's car works. You must be, you mean you're one of right. them, or like your house lights are on. And the fact that we get to the end and the aliens are just basically dicking around by flicking everyone's lights on and off. And Maple Street erupts into chaos. You know, there's people shooting each other and fighting and throwing rocks. And there's a really random shot in like the big wide shot of the street, and it shows some guy with a bar stool, which I'm sure is only there because they had a prop bar stool, and he's like, let's use that. No one's really going to pay any notice. But again, like in Eye of the Beholder, this is an episode which builds so nicely, and it's fitting you compare it, obviously, to John Carpenter's The Thing, because it is very much like the plot of Who Goes There. This idea of the enemy within. And just, I mean, the twist itself is really good. I mean, they remade the episode as part of the remake series. And in that one, they actually did change it out so that it's actually the government who are using it as an experiment to see how small towns react to the fear of terrorism, which I feel lacks the sort of power that we have with this one, where it's obviously, you know, it is the aliens that are obviously using their equipment, but the fact is, they're not going to use super advanced technology. They're not going to use ray guns to obliterate walls. All they're going to do is just turn the lights on and off a few times and let us wipe ourselves out.
Right. And it's in the defense of the 2003, the remake, you know, you had a different, entirely different thing at the time. I mean, one of the things about the Red Menace that I think tends to get overlooked quite a bit is the fact that you know, at least with like terrorists and the racist undertone of so much anti-terrorist, quote unquote, the racist undertones of the war on terror, it's okay, we have to go after, we have to, it's the brown guy, you know, whether it's, it's the brown guy, whether it's someone from, you know, from the Arab states or it's someone from Mexico, it's the fear of someone who doesn't look like us, you know,
yeah.
That's the thing. For the most part, you know, we have this sort of, right now we have this sort of security in the knowledge that, you know, when Al-Qaeda strikes or when the Mexican drug dealers strike, they're not going to be someone who looks like, Joe Caucasian next door. You know, they're going to look, you know, the other in this case is a physical marker. They do not have the same skin tone as we do. That's how we can set them apart. The whole thing about the Red Menace is the fear in something like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, or go again to the Thing, which has an almost all white cast and an all male cast of, you know, these are people, you know, Joe Smith next door could be a secret communist. You know, it's that, you know, if a Pakistani family moves in next door, we're perfectly justified, quote unquote, in wondering if they're really terrorists, but we can always be sure that, you know, Joe Normal isn't a terrorist, because we still have this kind of, even though particularly in America, where it really seems like, you know, where I shouldn't say it really seems, it actually is a statistic where like one only, you know, 9 in every 10 mass killings are basically carried out by white Christian right-wingers, you know, even though we have this kind of idea that it's going to be, the next attack is going to be coming from, you know, Khalid and, you know, so forth from Saudi Arabia. The real thing is that it's coming from Dylan Roof, and so forth, Timothy McVeigh. These people are white as they come. But we still kind of have that idea now that the idea is that, oh, when the monsters come, they're not going to look like us. And that's really kind of like the power here the monsters are doing on Maple Street. The thing is, none of these people can tell who the monster is because everybody's white. And I know that I'm probably, I know I'm maybe kind of like putting a lot of emphasis on the everybody's white bit here. But again, that's kind of like the thing. If you take a look at some of these older narratives about this, is that, you know, we can't tell, you know, when, you know, we can't tell who the enemy is because we all look the same.
It plays into it well. I mean, obviously, I mean, this is 1960s TV, so there isn't a huge amount of diversity on TV to begin with.
Right.
But like you said, I mean, this plays in perfectly. There's no obvious enemy. But the human mentality is that if we don't know there's an enemy, we're quite happy to make ourselves an enemy by just identifying one particular aspect that just makes someone stand out from the rest of the pack. And in this case, I mean, it's, as I said, the poor guy's just got insomnia, so he goes and looks at the stars. Never heard that, but in this circumstance, it's like, oh, you're looking for the other aliens, are you? And it's like, Steve, he's like, you know, he's just building a ham radio. Nothing wrong with that, but oh, you're using it to communicate with the other aliens.
Yeah.
Whatever innocent thing you happen to be doing. And I love again, this is perfectly ties in because of the era, because I mean, this is like the whole era. I mean, everybody knows each other. They're all like out on the street and you've got this real neighborhood vibe. And it's how quickly the distrust amongst them is. Whereas obviously now, I mean, neighborhoods are very sort of, nobody really has that sort of same neighborhood vibe. You don't know everyone who lives on the street anymore, compared to like when I was growing up and we knew pretty much everyone who was on the street and all the different families and stuff. And
you know, and that's kind of the interesting thing. It's like, I live in the town I grew up in. You know, I moved away from the town I grew up in for, and I didn't live there for about, about 15 years, and then I moved back. And when I was a kid, I knew everybody on my block. I knew the names of everybody who lived in not every, but on my block, I knew most of the families on the block. I don't even think I ever talked to any of my neighbors here. And I live I live not even 3 miles from where I grew up in the same town. I mean, that's kind of how much things have changed.
Yeah, I still don't come with my neighbor's name next, and we've lived next to each other. We both moved into a house at the same day, and it's been 6 years now, and I think it's gone past the point where I can ask him his name, so it's always very generalizations when we talk to each other, but that's modern living for
you. Yeah.
But I think this is just such an effective story. I mean, even though the violence is really toned down here, it's still super effective, like a cut head, a thrown rock, a smashed window. These little glimpses of violence that we get are so much more effective than if we had like some like very full-on element of violence. And it's just the idea of suggestion and just the way the tension at this point has been ramped up so much that you're buying into this paranoia that they're feeling. It's all like, well, is something going on here? Is this person there? An alien. It's weird how you buy into their paranoia, even though you're coming into this as a rational person here. You know what's supposedly going on, but at the same time, it draws you in, and you do actually start feeling that paranoia yourself.
Right. It's just, again, it's a masterpiece of how it kind of pacing and how it kind of takes all of these things and just gradually builds on them and builds on them. It's like, oh, yes, I know exactly, you know, where it's coming. Like, yeah, how does the kid? That is a weirdly, oddly specific thing. The kid knows what's going on because he read about it in a story in, like, fantasy and science fiction or it was in a comic book. It's really weird that the kid knows that, you know? It's just like, that's so weird. The kid knows exactly what's going on. You know, so you're sitting here, you're thinking, or when the guy comes back from the other, wait, isn't the hammer on the other side of his pants now? You know, you're looking for this stuff. You're looking for all this. Even though I know what the twist is, I'm still sitting here. It's like the whole thing where, you know, that one kind of, that shot at the end. I'm going to go back to the thing here, that shot at the end between Keith David and Kurt Russell at the end of the thing. You're always kind of looking for that thing that'll give you kind of like an in. You're looking for something to kind of go through and just something to interpret things a little bit further and try to get a little bit more stuff up. So you're looking, it's like, yeah, how does that happen? What does that happen? What does it happen this way? Why does it happen that way? You know, yeah. It's so engrossing. And again, the fact that it goes by very, very quickly and, you know, that it's an efficient as all hell. You know, again, it doesn't feel like something that goes on for like, it doesn't feel like it lasts. There's enough material in here for a feature film. You know, there's enough thematically. And in terms of all that, you could easily get a feature film out of this. And you, at the end, you're like, what, that was only 25 minutes? You know.
Well, I mean, the ending itself, I was so sure when you see them coming up, the guy, the hammer, walking up, I was so sure that it was going to be like, they find out it's a workman, and it's like a breaker down the street has blown. And that's why all the power went out. And it's like, it's nothing to do with aliens. It's just, you know, they just happened to have a power failure down the block, and that's why the power went out. But I'm really happy with the conclusion of the episode still. I think it's really effective, and certainly the reasons given for why they're doing what they're doing is even better. I mean, it's like almost like a classic H.G. Wells sort of
twist. Uh-huh.
I just can't help but like compare it to like War of the Worlds. You know, it's the simplest things that bring about your downfall. For the aliens, it's bacteria. For these people, it's paranoia. Uh-huh. But yeah, I think this is a stone cold classic.
It really is.
In terms of Twilight Zone, I understand why people love this episode so much.
I think like Eye Beholder, this is a very, this does everything that the Twilight Zone, that it does everything we remember the Twilight Zone for doing. It really is the kind of thing, when we think of the archetypal, when we think of what it is about when we think about the things that made the Twilight Zone endure for as long as it has. When we think of all those qualities and we start looking in our heads for episodes that embody those qualities, we're going to have a list of things almost, and we're going to be ticking a box. Everything that Twilight Zone does well is present in The Monsters Are Doing Maple Street. And it is just so iconic. It's another timeless message that basically says it's not even really that the things, it's not even necessarily that you have to look out for the, that you have to look out for what stands out. You don't have to go through and twist your mind into not trying to figure out what it is about something that stands out that allows you to scapegoat them. It's that it is so much easier for someone, it's like if we do this, the terrorists win. You know, we would make this joke constantly during the war on terror, not like the war on terror still isn't going on, but, you know, if we give up this freedom or if we give that freedom, we're giving the terrorists what they want kind of idea. And that's really kind of what this is. This is kind of like an idea of we're going to destroy ourselves. We have the capacity within us to destroy ourselves. And that can be triggered by just the smallest of things. And that somebody who knows that kind of weakness can use against us. So there's just so many levels of paranoia. And it's got Claude Aiken in it.
True. He's awesome. He's got a sort of voice that makes you think of Lemon Barley and Warm Summer Afternoons and the parson on The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Anything else?
No, that's about it.
Cool. Well, that brings us to the end of another exciting edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. I hope you've enjoyed our double dip into the exciting world of the Twilight Zone, and no doubt not the last time we're going to be visiting this region, for sure. Before we obviously get on to what's going to be on the next episode, we have to advise you as always to follow us on Facebook, like us on Twitter. You can also subscribe and follow the show and make iTunes. We are also through the podcast network on thatmomentin.com, where you can get the whole archive. We are also on Spotify as well, so plenty of ways to get to actually listen to the show. And leave us some feedback. Let us know what your thoughts on The Twilight Zone or any shows you'd like to see us cover. Coming up on the network, Game Warp are going to be looking at Abzu, which is a independent video game from the makers of Journey, which sees you exploring the depths of the ocean on a really fascinating and surreal journey there. Over on Cinema Recall, they have got an interview with Toby Nichols of The Dark. While we're obviously on the subject of film festivals as well, Kim Lowe has got the recaps and reviews from the BITS 2008 Film Festival over in Canada. So she's been reporting back from there. Over on the Asian Cinema Film Club, they have just looked at The Night Comes For Us, the ultra-violent martial arts flick, which is being marked as many as being the spiritual successor to The Raid, from the same director as The Killers and Headshot. So there's that as well. Whereas Cinema Recall, it is a double header of Suspiria, as Ben is going to be comparing the 1977 and 2008 remake. So definitely lots happening over on the podcast network. Check it all out on thatmomentin.com, which, of course, we are proud members of. But next episode is Christmas once again, which means it's time for a Christmas special. Lucky, what would you like to look at for your...
I would like to take a look at an episode of The Grim Adventures of Billy and Mandy. An episode very, very appropriately called Billy and Mandy Save Christmas.
Cool. As for myself, I'm going to continue our running theme of looking at Christmas specials. So we're going to be looking at A Muppet Family Christmas. This one is from 1987, and is probably best known for being the Henson production, which managed to see the Muppets cross over with their counterparts in both Fraggle Rock and Sesame Street. So it's going to be interesting diving into that and checking out some classic Muppet action there. But again, thank you as always for listening. Thank you to my co-host, Mr.
Thank you.
And I'm going to close tonight with the closing narration of Monsters of Joy on Maple Street. But I just remind you that the Tools of Conquest do not necessarily come with bombs and explosions and fallout. They're weapons that are simply thoughts, attitudes, prejudices to be found only in the minds of men. For the record, prejudice can kill, and suspicion can destroy, and a thoughtless, frightened search for a scapegoat has fallout all of its own. For the children, and the children yet unborn, and it is the pity it is us. That is, things cannot be confined to the Twilight Zone.